So let's get started. I'm just, it's not quite dry, this board, so I'll start at the side. So today I want to talk about differentiating on a manifold, but specifically not about the covariant differentiation. So I'm not going to be doing connections today, but I want to talk about other forms of differentiation that you can define on a manifold. So I guess, you know, our starting point in thinking about differentiation on a manifold is to sort of recall that in three dimensions, the usual vector calculus, you can define an operator, a differential operator, which to a large extent behaves something like a vector or covector. It doesn't really matter which, because in three-dimensional vector calculus, you've got three-dimensional flat Euclidean space, and you're usually dealing in Cartesian coordinates. So you have this differential operator that looks something like a vector. So derivatives or differentiation have a direction as well as a magnitude. So I'm not just sort of using this as a sort of notion or to start building up ideas about differentiation. So what goes wrong on a manifold? What happens if we try and think about this sort of construction on a manifold? So these derivatives, d by dxi here, give components. So we could imagine thinking about taking d by dxi of some object on our manifold. So let's think of what might happen to a vector field. And we'll do it a slightly old-fashioned way, just because it's quite useful to elucidate what goes wrong. So if we take dv mu by dx nu, so we're looking at imagining that this might be the components of the derivative of v, then if I do a change of coordinates, my vector components transform contravariantly. So they transform according to the, dx by dy, the inverse of the coordinate transformation between x and y. I've got my, sorry, that should be a new index. I put mu twice. So if I look at what happens under a coordinate transformation, if I just simply try and take partial derivatives, of course, this is not really news to you because you've already seen this before, but if I try and take partial derivatives, this is the transformed partial derivative, dv by dy, with the appropriate contravariant and covariant transformation matrices. But then there's an extra piece, which is not a tensor. But it is symmetric. So this is the usual argument or motivation for why just transporting this naive expression across doesn't work. And really, it should have been obvious that it wouldn't work, because if we think about it, d by dx I here, it's not really a geometric object. It kind of depends on choice of coordinates. And so we should go back and just think about how to define a derivative, and then work from there if we want to think about options for getting a geometric definition of a derivative. So if I look at my old standard real analysis, and I look at my definition of a derivative, it's a gradient at a point, and it's defined via a limiting process. I look at a function at a nearby point, I take away its value at the point I'm at, I divide by how far along I've gone, and then take the limit as this delta t goes to zero. It gives me the derivative. And so here, this t plus delta t expression is saying move a little bit away from where you are. And so if we think of this in the context of a manifold, this is implying that we have to move in the manifold. So this has consequences. Unless we've just got a function, this is telling us that that by moving to a different point, if we've got a vector, it's not living in the same vector space. So it's moved to a different tangent space of the manifold. So another feature of t plus delta t is that delta t, if you're moving to a different point in the manifold, delta t itself, sort of analogous to the notion of this being a vectorial operator, what do you mean by delta t? How do you step across to different neighboring points in the manifold? Okay, so you have to decide that. So we would like to think about how we make this geometric. So coordinates are not geometry. That was more or less what I was saying when I was saying that we shouldn't have expected this expression for the gradient to still hold on the manifold. And then the other way we can attack this expression for getting a geometric derivative is to use this notion of symmetry in that partial differentiation. The fact that if we look at the bit by which our partial derivative doesn't give us a tensor, it's symmetric. And so from the context of looking at the derivative formula up there, that's kind of saying that somehow you're mixing the notion of partial derivatives with the actual geometric object itself. So I've just brought out sort of three aspects of differentiation on the manifold, looking at a very familiar and very simple expression of a derivative, and use that to say, if we want to make a geometric derivative, these are the issues we've got to address. So the first issue about different points on the manifold, that one is quite a familiar one because you've already seen the connection on space-time. So you've seen a covariant derivative, and what the covariant derivative does is it gives you a way of linking tangent spaces together. So at two different points, you've got two different tangent spaces, but they are the same in the sense that they're both copies of R to the n. And so there's a map between them, and the connection tells you how to map between these tangent spaces. So the first point, thinking about the first point, leads you to the covariant derivative. The second point, how do we move to nearby points to compare our geometric object to two nearby points on the manifold? Again, the connection will do that for us. But this is going to lead us to the Lie derivative, where we say that we get to nearby points by moving along vector fields. That also actually takes care of the first point, because if we have a vector field, we can also move our tangent spaces along the vector field. But it's the final point that I want to look at first, which is this notion of anti-symmetry. So if I take... If I take an anti-symmetric derivative, then what we're going to see is that we can construct a geometric derivative. Is that a question?
Yes. Can you please elaborate on how the when a vector field is defined on the manifold, that uniquely, in some sense, solves the first two issues?
I'll do that when I come to the Lie derivative. So I'm doing the third point first. So when I come to the Lie derivative, you know, we'll actually need we'll need that property. So I'll come to that then.
So just to add to that, you can define any vector field on the manifold.
Sorry?
You can define or in some sense.
Well, all I really need if I'm looking at a derivative is something in the neighborhood of the point where I'm taking the derivative. So I could imagine some field which was singular, either at some point or in some region, and as long as I wasn't going near that region, I would be fine. So, all I ever need to define a derivative is a neighborhood of a point.
Yeah.
So,
So, in a manifold, you have a knotless, right? So,
mm-hmm.
what's wrong basically going back to our N and using the differential structure of our N? Why do we have to have all of these sort of?
So if you try to use the differential structure of our N, the way you uplifted it, well, it's a bit like doing that partial differentiation. It's going to be dependent on that particular chart. So if you, so I guess what that sort of little formula calculation, whatever, was meant to illustrate on that top board was saying that if you, you know, if you're in an overlap of charts and you try and do something, if you go down to R to the N, you would have grad, okay? You just have the gradient operator. So that is the partial differentiation that I've done there. That's uplifted my R to the N differential operator into the manifold. The problem is that as soon as I go to a different chart, I don't get what I should get if that in the second chart I was doing the same uplift of my gradient operator. So the uplift of my gradient operator in my Y chart there is that thing I boxed in the middle. And then if I wanted to change that rank 1-1 tensor in my Y chart to a rank 1-1 tensor in my X chart, it would be the first expression on the right-hand side. But that doesn't, that's not the whole story, okay? Because in general, transformations between coordinate transformations can have a lot of freedom in them. Okay. So our first our first look at a geometric derivative that doesn't rely on a metric or connection is the exterior derivative. But in order to talk about the exterior derivative, I'm also going to have to introduce some new geometric quantities called forms, because the exterior derivative only acts on a special set of tensors. So the exterior derivative is going to be called D. And we've kind of already seen it a little bit. So let me just talk about what it does on something simple. Then that will sort of point us towards what we need for our objects to act on, which is a form. And then we'll define D in general. So the idea of D is it's going to map a function to a covector, and we're now going to relabel our covector a one form. So D takes some function into our covector field, and it's such that let me define it just at P, actually. So the idea is that DF, because it's a covector, that means it's a linear map from TP of M down to the reals. So I take an element of the tangent space T at point P, and I act on it by DF, and what I get is the number TF. And that's true for every single element of TP of M. So this is sort of saying that DF is an independent geometric object. And if we look in the coordinate basis, we get something quite familiar. We just get the partial derivatives of f with respect to x mu. So df looks like our gradient operator in standard vector calculus. So it's something familiar. So what we then want to do is to extend this notion just realized I've got another blackboard over there. It's the fact that So now we want to think about what, you know, how could we extend D to act on something other than just functions? Well, it's taken a function and it's given us a covector. So we have this notion of differentiation giving us covariant or covector type of indices or covector properties. So if we want to go from a single rank one covector to a rank two covector, and we don't want to fall afoul of this problem with coordinate transformations, this suggests that we're going to need some form of anti-symmetry. So if we need some form of anti-symmetry, this means that we should probably just be thinking about anti-symmetric objects to act on with our derivative. So if a covector is a one form, we want to think of what a p-form is. So a p-form, just in words, is a rank p covariant tensor which is completely anti-symmetric. So we have a sort of label for how we construct these anti-symmetric covariant tensors. We construct them using the wedge product or the exterior product. So we define our wedge product. Yep.
The p that you have in the Cotangent space is a point in the
manifold. Oh yeah, that's true, isn't it? Okay. I'll call this one Q then. Yeah. Or you could call it P primed. Yep. It is a distinct P anyway. So good point. Is that another? Could have, but I'm going to use N for something else in a moment. So,
could there not be some indication of which point it is on the left-hand side?
Yes, there should be. Or I could just, I guess I could just delete them all together and have the bundle, but let me. Right. So if I want to take A wedge B for one forms. Then I simply take the anti-symmetric tensor product of two one forms, so A tensor B minus B tensor A. And so generally, if I have a P form and a Q form, and I look at the components, so I think the component way is probably just the easiest way of seeing how this anti-symmetric tensor product crops up. So for one forms, it's quite easy to show. It's sort of the obvious thing. You just take A, B, and then reverse the order. But for a general rank P and rank Q form, it's easier to see via anti-symmetrization. So so at the moment, you don't need to see, because I'm telling you a P form is this object, okay? So I'm simply taking a little side route at the moment to defining P forms. Then when we come back to D, we're going to see that the definition of D is talking about these, you know, mapping P forms to P plus one forms. So at the moment, this is just saying this is what a P form is. This is what the exterior product is, the wedge product. And, you know, then I'm going to just, have you seen this notation, anti-symmetry, symmetry? Yeah, okay. And so, the tensor product, yeah. It's a generalization of the tensor product. But it's only defined on these covariant objects. Okay? So it's almost anti-commutative. It's obviously anti-commutative for two one forms, but if I have a general P form wedge a general Q form and try and swap the order, then I get a minus sign if the product of P and Q is odd. So this is how, I mean, from the perspective of the old-fashioned sort of index notation, abstract index notation, it's reasonably clear how to deal with anti-symmetric objects. And I'm just sort of trying to give a little bit of where the definitions come from. And if I look at this expression in particular, then I can see that if I try and put too many of these indices in other words, if I try and take the rank of a P form to be too big, eventually I'm going to come up against the dimensionality of the space. If I'm anti-symmetrizing on P plus Q indices, that means that if I have two indices the same value, I get zero. So each of these indices has to take a different value, and since it can only take n, up to n, where n is the dimensionality of the manifold, can only take up to n values, that means I can only have up to a rank n form. So I can't just go on taking these anti-symmetric products. I have to stop when I reach the dimensionality of the manifold. So just while I'm on the topic of forms, I just want to just add in a little, again, I seem to be sort of going on sidelines. There is a Rankine n form. So we can define the alternating symbol, and I've put this as an epsilon that's not a curly epsilon, to be either plus or minus one, depending on whether A12AN is an odd or an even permutation of 1 to n, or the number of coordinates that you actually have. Now you can. If you have an n form, it's anti-symmetric, so that means it's going to be a function times plus or minus 1. And so we can just consider what, trying to sort of see, and if we were in Cartesian coordinates or standard Euclidean Cartesian vector or tensor algebra, this object epsilon would be an invariant tensor because it's something that sort of under transformations or under sort of straightforward rotation, transformations of our basis remains as plus or minus one. So strictly speaking, it's actually something called a tensor density, which means if I do a more complicated coordinate transformation, I pick up factors of the Jacobian, the determinant of my coordinate transformation. So if I look at epsilon mu nu lambda rho, for example, so it's saying that you pick up factors of the determinant of your coordinate transformation. So it is a tensor. It's something that does transform like a tensor, but it picks up a factor of this, this Jacobian. And so if we have a metric, then I can use the metric to make this into a bona fide tensor because if I look at my metric, it transforms covariantly. I take its determinant, I'm going to get the Jacobian squared. So if I define now what I'm going to call my curly epsilon, as the square root of the metric determinant times this alternating symbol, then you see that under a coordinate transformation, the square root of the determinant transforms with a dy dx. In this context, this is going from the x system to the y system. Here I've gone from the y system to the x system, just to be annoying. So you can see that the alternating symbol gets a factor of the Jacobian, the square root of g gets its inverse, and so overall, this transforms as a tensor. So therefore, with the metric, we can use the, we can use this epsilon tensor to actually hop between different different forms. So we can take ourselves from a p form to an n minus p form. And we do this essentially by taking this epsilon tensor and contracting with our p form. So you can see that I need a metric in order to be able to raise and lower indices. So this is the Hodge dual. And what this then does is it kind of completes the structure of these anti-symmetric spaces, products of the tangent spaces of the manifold, and you can see that you can sort of hop between different p forms or n minus p form constructs on the manifold. So in order to see what you now do with differentiation, so I'm kind of trying to sort of say that you've got all these different spaces and that, you know, you can find ways of actually going from one to the next. So first of all, we've just defined what we mean by P forms. I've shown that if you've got a metric, at least, although this is kind of an aside, you can go but swap between P and N minus P forms. But the exterior derivative now is what's going to take us from P forms to p plus 1 forms. So if I look at the expression for the derivative of a p form, then what it does is it says, take the partial derivative of my p form A but then anti-symmetrize over all possible permutations of the indices. So that's what my P form actually, sorry, that's what my exterior derivative actually is. Mathematically, what you need to define it is to say that it reduces to just d on functions, that d squared of f is zero, and also that it's a derivation in the sense that it's sort of pseudo-Leibnizian. So what I mean by that So typically when you're trying to define a derivative, you usually want it to be to have this property that d of f times g is f prime times g plus f times g primed. And so here it's the same thing, d. You've got d of a wedge b is going to be dA wedge b, and then you've got a wedge dB, but it's not necessarily plus because you're dealing with these anti-symmetric objects. So the Leibniz rule is just modified to allow for the anti-symmetry. And then, of course, you can also use the dual. So to define a map from lambda p to lambda p minus 1. So you can now start to see how you can link together these different spaces. So if I want to compare or to think about an example, then, yeah?
When you define this delta map with the Hodge tool, it only works for p greater than 1, right? What happens if I use this derivation on a scalar function?
Oh, yeah, because if you take the dual of a scalar, you go to an n form, then you try and take d, that would want to map you to an n plus 1 form, which is 0. Yeah. So it kind of, it kills itself off, yeah? So so electromagnetism is naturally described as a gauge theory, and our gauge potential, A mu, is just constructed by using, in terms of Maxwell's original sort of ideas, a sort of vector potential and the scalar potential. So this is a one form, and so we can say, well, what is dA? Well, if I look at at my expression for d, d is just taking an anti-symmetric partial derivative. So if it's one form, that's just going to say, well, I take d mu of a nu, and then I subtract off the same thing with the order of the indices reversed. So that's applying what my d is in components. And so if I write down what that is, then obviously it's an anti-symmetric tensor because it's a two-form. And what I get is the Maxwell stress tensor. So quite a lot of known features of electromagnetism come out very, very easily from this language of forms, because since d squared is zero, I know that df equals zero. And so if I then put in what that implies in terms of my E's and B's, that is half of the Maxwell equations. Then the other half, in a source-free context, is actually delta F is zero. Our gauge invariance well, if I add A goes to A plus D lambda, if I add on the exterior derivative of a function, then dA goes to dA plus d lambda, which is just dA, so I get no change at all. So it tells me what my gauge invariance is. So that's sort of quite a nice way of thinking about Maxwell's equations. So it's a nice way of formulating them. And so given that I've talked about p-forms, you could say, well, why did you pick a one form? Why not do any sort of form? And the answer is, why not? So you can also generalize this to an arbitrary P form. So for example, if I took a two form, B mu nu, then my gauge transformations would be B goes to B plus dA. So if I just put in brackets, just to emphasize the dimensionality of the form, that's saying the two form shifts to the two form plus d of a one form, and then my field strength h is db, and in components, because of the anti-symmetry of B, I can sort of carve the number of terms on the right-hand side. And so this is an example of a gauge theory that's now has a p-form rather than just a one-form. And so this is used, this two-form, or indeed p-forms, these are used in string theory and supergravity. So, for example, in electromagnetism, we've got a coupling A mu to a charged particle. So we get a term which is sort of like A times x dot. If we want to couple to a charged particle, for B mu nu, if I want to couple to something charged, I've got two indices now. So my B mu nu couples to a string. I had a three form, it would couple to a membrane, and so on. So that's one way of taking a geometric derivative. So I just want to spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about an alternative way. Which is the Lie derivative. And so the Lie derivative is something which takes derivative along a vector field. So this is where we've got this notion, let's say V. So we think we've got some vector field. And I'm just going to focus in locally now. If I'm at a point P and I want to think about taking a derivative of some geometric object, remember, to take the derivative, we need to look at the value of our field. I'll just think now of a vector. We need to compare the vector field at a nearby point. And here, we're going to use these curves which define our vector field V in order to go to a nearby point. So this is not a generalized derivative in the sense of grad or the covariant derivative, the standard connection in GR, because we're not taking a sort of notion of the way our geometric object is changing in every direction. We're being very specific. We're saying, well, we'll sacrifice this generality of our derivative, the notion that it might have a direction, and say we're going to fix a direction and just talk about how it changes in that direction. So that we'll sacrifice our generality in order to get something geometric that doesn't need a connection on our space. So here we're using the fact that we can take our vector field, we use it to give ourselves a incremental, just infinitesimal, coordinate transformation on our manifold. So, I mean, there's a sort of what's underlying this is the notion that if we look locally, we can generate a diffeomorphism of our manifold simply by pushing along these curves of V, and then that allows us to link vector spaces at the point P to points P prime, which are along this curve, the tangent vector of which is V. So if I look So if I look at what that means, what I'm thinking of doing is saying that if I start off here at the point P, so that's my x0 mu, and I just move a small amount, delta t, along this curve, then to leading order, my coordinate transformation is just xt is x0 plus delta t times v. So you're just going a little distance, delta t, along the tangent vector. So the u, my vector field that I want to take the derivative of, so under this coordinate transformation, so this is a coordinate transformation. I haven't got them x and y. I've labeled them x naught and xt. Under that coordinate, under any coordinate transformation, u is going to transform contravariantly. So I've written down here my u in the t system is going to be equal to dxt by dx naught, u in the naught system, which is just going to be u naught plus delta t and then I need to take dxt by dx naught, so I get just a Kronecker delta, and then a delta t term, which is the derivative of v. So that's what my transformation is, just of the u vector. So we can use this to define our derivative, because we now have a means of transforming our u from the point P to the point P prime. So I'm using that, the definition of the derivative that I wrote down, just your standard old sort of calculus derivative. You take f of x plus h, so I look at the value of the vector field at xt or point p primed. I want to subtract off the value at x naught. I can't subtract directly the value at x naught because it's a different tangent space. But I do a coordinate transformation to get me from x0 to xt, and that tells me what the, if I push forward that u from p to p primed, tells me how to do it. So I pick up this extra piece here. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I'm just doing it for a vector field. So I'm going to do it from this perspective, which will generalize to any geometric object, because once I'm sort of, you know, it's just easiest to see it with a vector first. Because for any geometric object, I know the coordinate transformation between x naught and xt, and I just use either dxt by dx naught or the other way around, if it's a covariant object, to push forward the geometric object from x naught to xt. And then I have to compare that to the value of the field that's already there.
Okay.
So, but I'm doing it for the vector first because there's another way of defining the lead derivative just for vectors.
Right.
And it's, you know, to see the comparison.
So the object that's acting on needs to also be a field, though. It can't just be like a tensor at a point. So U needs to also be a vector field or a tensor field or whatever. It can't just be a vector at a point.
At a particular point, no, because if you want to take a derivative, you always need something in a neighborhood.
Right.
So there's a notion of continuity at the very least. And of course, in the context of general relativity, or looking at fields on space-time, we're going to be imagining fields that are, you know, essentially infinitely differentiable except for certain special points or special places. So yes, you need it to be a vector field, although typically, I'm emphasizing this at P because I'm going back to, I'm drawing the analogy with the standard definition of dfdx.
Okay.
Yep. So, and you always, when you first sort of encounter differentiation, you're always looking at the derivative of a function at an explicit point because the intuition is that it's the gradient at that point, and so you kind of can see it by drawing it. So here, it's really proceeding by analogy, but trying to make what I write down something that refers to the manifold itself. So if I look at what this is, my value, if I look at u at the point xt, so it's u mu, if I look at the components at x naught, I'm not having a good day today, am I? So here we're looking at what's the value of my vector field at xt? Well, it's the vector field at x naught plus the derivative of the vector field along v times delta t. And so, luckily, the leading terms cancel, and what I'm left with is something which depends on delta t, taking the limit. Delta t goes to naught. I see that my lead derivative is the partial derivative of u along v minus the partial derivative of v projected onto u. So that's my lead derivative for vectors. And if I did the same thing but with a covector, then I get something very similar, but there's a plus sign instead of a minus sign. And so that tells me how I'm going to build up to some arbitrary geometric object, which, to be honest, I could have done right from the very beginning. I could have said, well, you know, the first term, u at xt gives me, or my quantity at xt gives me the quantity at x naught, plus the derivative of the object along v, and then the second part will be all these derivatives of the coordinate transformation. So I just want to say that for vectors...
Sorry. So you read it that way over there. Shouldn't it be contracted the mu with a basis vector? You need something that is coordinate independent.
Yeah, so I've... Here I have not put a coordinate. I think when I wrote this down, I muttered that the mu index, okay? So let's just to be accurate, let's just write that in there. But we can also define, for vectors only, our Lie derivative as a Lie bracket, a commutator, where I define it essentially by considering its action on functions. So my vector is a map C infinity of M into C infinity of M. So I can use another vector to map C infinity of M to C infinity of M to C infinity of M. UF is a function, so I can take V acting on it. V is a function, VF is a function, so I can take U acting on it. And so this gives me the commutator of the vectors v and u. And this is exactly the same as the Lie derivative of u along v. So you get this nice link to, again, this algebraic structure that's kind of sitting hidden behind all the analysis that you do when you're looking at differentiable manifolds. So the Lie derivative is the other main geometric way of taking a derivative of an object vector or covector or whatever on the manifold that doesn't need a connection. You can see it's restricted because you need to have this underlying crutch of the vector field V in order to take the derivative. However, you know, that said, it's still something that can be defined. At the start tomorrow, we'll look about what it's, you know, what it means geometrically. And Lie derivatives turn out to be quite important because in the end, we use them to tell us something about symmetries when we're sort of looking at space-time. So they tell us something about sort of symmetries or conserved quantities in the end. Okay, I better stop because the next lecture is going to start. And hopefully I haven't trashed the place completely.